Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 61 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. At any time, you can email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. And if I do, and you include your mailing address, I'll send you a small gift. This week's feedback, before we get to the subject of this week's podcast. John on Facebook said, Jim West, that was episode 60 on ultrasound, has a very sharp mind. The risks of ultrasound in pregnancy are clear to see. Don't have ultrasound unless you want to risk terrible damage to the baby. Shocker, The Dangers of Ultrasound by John Rappaport also covers this issue. One comment by John Manley states that this doesn't surprise me. His wife went through a high-risk pregnancy. She was having ultrasounds every single day or thereabouts for months. Their son was born blind. Correlation isn't proved, but it does make me suspicious that the ultrasounds didn't help, and maybe they harmed. It is with some trepidation that I address the issue of sexual assault. Because I'm a man and I am foolish enough to feel driven to talk about the current apparent rash of high-profile false reports of sexual assault, and also the redefinition of sexual assault that could turn the awkward into the criminal. What does the mainstream media's handling of these cases tell us about what's politically correct and what's wrong with our current state of political correctness? It is perhaps easier for a woman to talk about this, just as in any criticism of a disadvantaged group, it is easier for an insider because they are relatively immune from criticism. But I've never liked to hide my opinions, and I've never liked injustice, so I feel compelled to talk about it. It is true that sexual assault or rape, usually with a woman as the victim, has been dismissed in the past, and we're talking from the earliest recorded history up to the present. There have been many women afraid of reporting serious sexual crimes because they don't think that they will be taken seriously, or they will be blamed, their sexual history will be exposed for everyone to see, and at the end of it, they may see the aggressor walk free. So what's the point? We can all agree that sex is a beautiful thing between two consenting adults, and that forcing anyone to endure sexual contact, whether it is actually penetrative sex or just unwanted touching, is wrong and often criminal. However, while it might not seem like it, there is a lot of gray between what we might call good sex and what is clearly criminal sexual assault, or even sexual behavior that's sanctionable in other ways, such as by being expelled from a job or a university. One problem that I see is that our modern culture, in response to millennia of ignoring or even encouraging sexual assault, appears to assume that women so rarely file false sexual assault allegations that this possibility can be ignored. This is good intentioned in that if women are faced with a wall of skepticism, they probably won't report. The problem is that if reports of sexual assault are not treated skeptically, then some men will be falsely sanctioned or convicted, possibly facing years in jail. The modern redefinition of consent also is a problem. The problem lies in between clear verbal consent for every activity, and on the other side, explicit non-consent, i.e. no means no. What if one partner initiates a type of contact, such as oral or anal sex, and the other submits but doesn't really like it, but doesn't want to say no? The modern redefinition of consent is that every step of the way there needs to be verbal consent. But sex is not an activity that by its nature needs to be verbal, and many lovers, both men and women, may feel that this interferes with spontaneity. But even if we accept that explicit consent is necessary, usually sexual activity occurs in private, so one party will say there was explicit consent, and the party alleging sexual impropriety will say that there was not, and without witnesses, how can we possibly know the truth? This problem applies in other areas, such as condom use in HIV-positive people. These people, if they have not revealed their status to a sexual partner, can go to jail if they don't use a condom. But again, the HIV-positive person will say they did. Their partner will say they didn't, and there are very likely no witnesses and no physical evidence. So how is a judge supposed to know the truth? Consent not only has to be given explicitly, but now it also has to be informed. In a recent case documented in The Nation, a young black man was sentenced to 60 years in jail for having sex with white men without revealing his HIV status. The logic is that although consent might have been given explicitly, it was not informed. This can be extended to absurd extremes. In Israel, a Jewish woman had sex with a man she assumed was Jewish because he used the name Daniel. But after having sex that was explicitly consensual, she accused him of rape using the logic that if she had known he was Palestinian, she would never have agreed. And he was convicted. What about men who lie about being married, or having children, or about being rich? This raises another issue that advocates of tightening the rules on consent apparently haven't thought much about. Sex without informed consent will ensnare women as much as men. Women are also HIV positive, lie about their marital status, lie about whether they have children, and exaggerate their financial situation. Could we see women who are HPV positive, a virus that some people think causes cancer in men, could we see them be convicted of aggravated sexual assault because they refused to get vaccinated and told their man that they had? The phrase innocent until proven guilty also appears to have gone out of style, not just in this arena, but it's particularly important here. The problem with sexual assault is that this principle would mean that the accused, usually a man, in a common situation where there are no witnesses and no physical evidence, will have a huge advantage and will probably be found not guilty. But the reality of modern justice is it boils down to an assessment of the personalities of the accuser and the accused. When the judge or other arbiter believes the accuser, usually a woman, and doesn't believe the accused, this standard, innocent until proven guilty, can be bypassed. Is this an improvement on the old standard where the judge seemed to always believe the man accused of sexual assault and not the accuser? Another question worth investigating is the notion of responsibility for behavior while under the influence. While both men and women are responsible for their actions while drunk or stoned in most situations, for example, driving a car and injuring or killing someone, there is an asymmetry in sexual matters. If a man has a few drinks, he is still responsible for his sexual activity, such as, for example, having sex with a woman who is clearly incapacitated or forcing a woman to have sex. And clearly, that is appropriate. But as we shall see, this standard does not apply to women. Even a single drink appears to immunize a woman for responsibility for bad decisions, even if they clearly initiated the sexual activity, even if the activity is clearly consensual. They can wake up the next morning, decide the sex was a bad decision, and then file a complaint. This is not to minimize the fact that women are singled out for sexual harassment and crimes. A Salon article from May 29, 2015, entitled "Twitter Trolls, Your Days Are Numbered," documents some horrendously abusive verbal attacks on women related to what's known as Gamergate, the issue of the sexual treatment of women figures in video games. For example, with the worst expletives removed, feminist frequencies Anita Sarkeesian, who has criticized computer games for misogyny, canceled an event at Utah State University after receiving an anonymous email threat that stated, "I have at my disposal a semi-automatic rifle, multiple pistols, and a collection of pipe. This will be the deadliest school shooting in American history, and I'm giving you a chance to stop it. One way or another, I'm going to make sure they die. She is going to die screaming like the craven little whore that she is if you let her come to Utah State University." Another game developer, a woman, had her personal information posted on the internet and faced both internet and phone messages like, "I've got a K-bar, a type of survival knife, and I'm coming to your house so I can shove it up your ugly feminist," and then the C-word. I previously talked about the YouTube-inspired phenomenon in which men, usually inebriated to give them more courage, go up to a woman reporter who is filming an interview and disrupt her by yelling, "F her in the pisser." Only women have to tolerate this. There is the reality that women are the target of most sexual violence, although male-on-male sexual assault is definitely also a problem, especially in places like prisons, and also the reality that the vast majority of sexual predators are male. Not quite 100%, but pretty close. I like to look at the numbers. There are about 300 million Americans, about 150 million male. So if 1% are sexually abusive, that's about 1.5 million. That's a lot. But then if you randomly pick a man and don't properly evaluate accusations against him, there would still be a 99% chance that he is not one of the bad guys. So there needs to be a balance, and no matter where the line is drawn, a lot of sexual offenders will get off, and it is likely that some innocent men will be punished with years in jail in some cases. And like all judicial issues, wealthier men with good lawyers and intense courtroom preparation are much more likely to get off. Men without financial resources, often colored, who don't understand to dress and act in court, nor what keywords the judge does and doesn't want to hear, are much more likely to get punished. Let's look at some individual, well-publicized cases and see what awkward messages we can get from the public handling of them. A famous case of false rape accusations, or accusations that most people now think are false, occurred at Duke University in 2006. But it was a case in which neither side came out looking good. According to Wikipedia, in March 2006, Crystal Gayle Mangum, an African-American student at North Carolina Central University who worked as a stripper, dancer, and escort, falsely accused three white Duke University students, all members of the Duke Blue Devils men's lacrosse team, of raping her. The alleged rape occurred at a party held at the house of two of the team's captains in Durham on March 13, 2006. Many persons involved in or commenting on the case, including District Attorney Nifong, stated or suggested that the alleged rape was a hate crime. In response to the allegations, Duke University suspended the lacrosse team for two games on March 28, 2006. The following week, Duke lacrosse coach Mike Pressler was forced to resign under threat by athletic director Joe Elia, and Duke president Richard Broadhead canceled the remainder of the 2006 season. Approximately a year later, on April 11, 2007, North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper dropped all charges and declared the three lacrosse players innocent. While the accusations of rape appear to have been false, it is true that the lacrosse team members were upset to begin with when two non-white women showed up when they had booked white strippers, which seems racist to me. Worse than that, one of the young men joked about using a broomstick as a sex toy, which really isn't very funny when you are two women surrounded by a group of inebriated and very athletic men. It wasn't just the men who were drunk, however. One of the strippers had also consumed drugs and alcohol before showing up to work. The cause of the false allegations was probably because the men refused to fully pay for striptease that was aborted by the broomstick incident. Given that the strippers were black and the men were white, presumably entitled because they were at a famous and expensive university, they were entitled college athletes, the story resonated with the public and punishments were meted out before the facts were known. This case is a good example of the gray areas that occur. Clearly, the strippers had a right to stop their show if they felt threatened, and clearly the men should have paid because it was their fault that they made the women uncomfortable. And the women probably felt that they had little leverage to get paid and probably didn't understand just what would happen when they falsely alleged rape. One of the messages is how easily we can believe a story without all the facts when it seems to fit a pattern. Entitled white college athletes rape two poor black strippers. It's probably happened many times in the past, but clearly not every time it has been alleged. The most spectacular recent flame-out is certainly the November 2014 Rolling Stone article, A Rape on Campus, by Sabrina Erdely. The woman in the story, known by the pseudonym Jackie, claimed to have been invited to her first frat party. Her date at some point took her upstairs into a darkened room where a bunch of men were waiting, and she was raped by seven men while lying on broken glass from the coffee table that was broken when she was pushed down. When she returned to her dorm, traumatized and bleeding, her friends were unsympathetic, telling her not to report what was a serious violent crime because it might impact her social status and college career. Except that almost everything about this story turned out to be false, according to, among others, research by T. Reese Shapiro and Paul Farhi in the Washington Post. The lifeguard who took her to the frat party probably does not exist. There were, in fact, no fraternity members who worked at the university pool. There was no party recorded at the frat house that night. The photo sent to friends of her date was not only not a lifeguard, he was a high school classmate of Jackie, who was not at the University of Virginia, claimed to barely know Jackie, and hadn't even seen her for about 6 years. It is true that Jackie returned that night traumatized, although not injured or bleeding. But nobody has ever provided an explanation of what did happen. According to them, it was her friends who encouraged Jackie to go to the police, and it was Jackie who refused. The failings of the Rolling Stone reporter are now legendary. She didn't contact the friends. She didn't verify the existence and identity of Jackie's supposed date that night. She didn't contact the fraternity to try to verify the plausibility of the allegations. People have blamed the journalist and are horrified that anyone would blame Jackie, but I think that the journalist was just doing what we are being trained to do. She believed the victim and agreed with her editors to not pursue avenues that the victim claimed would further traumatize her. She was trying to protect the interests of the victim and probably didn't think about the harm that could be done to the accused, which in this case was more an institution than a person. But what if Jackie did make it all up? What if the trauma was something other than sexual assault, such as bombing a series of midterms, getting dumped by a boyfriend, embarrassing herself at a party? The list of possibilities on a campus are endless. And one would think that if Jackie made up this story to cover up some other trauma in her life, she is responsible for the damage that was caused by the false allegations. Huffington Post reported that, quote, many people lashed out at Rolling Stone magazine on Twitter for blaming the alleged victim instead of taking full responsibility for reporting accuracy, end quote. Well, it is certainly true that the magazine is fully responsible for the tremendous journalistic lapses, but that doesn't mean that Jackie isn't also responsible for telling a false story. The Rolling Stone magazine was criticized for saying that it had, quote, misplaced trust in Jackie. They apologized for something that's clearly true. They had misplaced trust in Jackie. But the apology is necessary to ensure that the simple picture remains. The women are always the victim, especially nice, white, wealthy, educated women, and it is always a man who did something wrong. Even in this case, where there is not a shred of evidence that any man did anything wrong. In the case of the Jackie story, no real man has been identified as the supposed rapist. The Guardian newspaper took a similar position. Quote, the sentiment within the magazine remains the same. The blame for problems with their reporting is Jackie's, and any mistakes were made out of a fear of further traumatizing a rape victim. End quote. That statement is actually quite true. The magazine genuinely did not want to traumatize Jackie, which is why they backed off on normal journalistic standards. If they did anything wrong, it was continuing to pursue an unverifiable story. Are the Huffington Post and the Guardian truly immune from falling into the trap of a story that's too good to be true? Perhaps Jackie can explain what the trauma was. Perhaps she eventually will. And perhaps it does involve a sexual assault, although there appears to be no evidence for this at present. Even then, while the story she spun might be understandable, it will not be fully forgivable. As the Washington Post said, Jackie accused the Phi Kappa Psi fraternity members of being criminal sexual assault conspiracists, planners, and long-range schemers. If it was someone else who had sexually assaulted her, her actions were still harmful to the fraternity and its members, with no justification. In the current situation where justice is about punishment, it is unlikely that the truth will come out. Jackie's lawyers have surely advised her that anything she says, except asserting that her story is true, could end up with her at the receiving end of a criminal charges or a major lawsuit. Already there are the predictable lawsuits against Rolling Stone magazine from the fraternity. Another case I mentioned in episode 42 in my discussion with Judith Levine. As reported by Emily Yaffe in Slate magazine, Drew Sterrett roomed at the University of Michigan with another young man. A young woman they both knew knocked on the door at night and asked if she could sleep in their room because her roommate had family members staying there. The boys thought that she would crash on the floor, but she crawled in with Drew, and pretty soon they were kissing and then noisily having sex to the point that the boy on the lower bunk sent a Facebook message. This is the 21st century, after all. Complaining about this. They had sex three times that night, and there was a witness. Everything seemed to be okay, although both were a bit embarrassed because they weren't romantically involved, and all were in the same circle of friends. The problem started when later the woman's mother found her diary, and at this point the woman said that the sex wasn't consensual, possibly to preserve her image as a virginal, studious young woman to her mother. There was a university process that sanctioned the man, and he felt it was impossible to continue his studies, so he withdrew. And now there's a big lawsuit against the university. This case illustrates the double standard with alcohol. Both Drew Sterrett and the unarmed woman had been drinking, but not excessively. But while the man was still responsible for his following actions, the woman wasn't. While the sex was clearly consensual, putting aside the issue of whether consent can be formed after alcohol, her consent was waived due to alcohol, and his wasn't. This also illustrates a plausible reason for false allegations, shame and embarrassment, because societal norms are that nice young women, i.e. those from well-off families, go to university to learn and study and only have good, clean fun, not sexual exploits which could be considered shameful, such as casual sex with a non-boyfriend. If Drew Sterrett had been the one with a diary, and this had been discovered by his mother, it seems unlikely that anything would have been done about it. Societal prejudices would have probably led his mother to just tut-tut and blame a young man sowing his wild oats. Given that university is often the first time and place that young people, men and women, are free from parental oversight, it is not surprising that it is a time to experiment with sex as well as drugs and alcohol. But it is unlikely that too many young people want to report what they are really doing to their parents, who are often the funders of all the fun. And if it comes out in an embarrassing way, they will probably try to come up with explanations or excuses. And for a young woman to claim that it was non-consensual sex, especially given how much attention is given to sexual assault on campuses these days, is an easy way out. Although, in the end, perhaps not as easy as it seemed at the time. When I heard about Emma Sulkowitz carrying a mattress on her back to protest Columbia University's refusal to act on allegations of an August 2012 anal rape, during which she was hit and strangled by a privileged sports star at the university, I immediately believed her story. Perhaps titles like the Huffington Post's Columbia University Student Will Drag Her Mattress Around Campus Until Her Rapist Is Gone made it clear that the rape was proven. Her actions of not just revealing her name, but making herself so visible on campus with the mattress seemed brave. She even turned her activism into her final year art project, carrying a dorm mattress to every class. Why would someone do this if they hadn't actually been sexually assaulted? My confidence in the story was compounded when two other female students alleged to have been raped by the same man. Her alleged rapist, meanwhile, was still apparently walking about campus without restrictions, without consequences. It seemed like a total failure of the university, and yet another institutional unwillingness to deal with the issue of sexual assault. Like most people, I knew nothing about the alleged rapist. Few people did, except some at the university, until Sulkowitz outed him by filing a police report. That man, the accused rapist, we now know as Paul Nungesser, an architecture student from Germany who is now suing Columbia University. He was not a sports star and he was not from a wealthy family. He was only able to attend prestigious Columbia University because he received a full scholarship. He was brought up, ironically, in an egalitarian and progressive household by a mother who has worked for a long time as a journalist for the National Council of German Women's Organizations, a mother who is a writer on a feminist blog and whose writings have covered feminist theory, women in the media, discrimination against migrant women, and so on. Her father has equally progressive credentials. Both have solidly supported him. Investigations, particularly by journalist Kathy Young in Reason magazine and on the Daily Beast, based on documents from and conversations with both Sulkowitz and Nungesser, paint an entirely different picture than the dominant narrative. Sulkowitz did not allege that she had been raped until about a year afterwards. In itself, this doesn't mean anything, but clearly her behavior during that year is of great interest. It is agreed by both parties that they did have sex, including anal sex on that occasion. The question is just about whether the sex was consensual and whether it was loving or hateful. Nungesser has preserved their Facebook conversations, which Sulkowitz apparently did authenticate, and they show that for almost 2 months following the alleged rape, Sulkowitz was sending friendly, even loving messages. When he invited her to a party a couple of days after the alleged rape, she responded, "We need to have some real time where we can talk about life and things, because we still really haven't had a Paul Emmer chill session since summer." She suggested that they hang out before or after a meeting that they were both attending with the message, "Whatever, I want to see you. Nungesser's complaint against the university also points out that the alleged violence happened in a poorly soundproofed dorm room, yet nobody heard anything worrying. Sulkowitz did not seek any medical attention afterwards, and nobody noticed anything physically wrong with her in the following days, such as the marks around her neck that you would expect from being half-strangled. Nungesser was found innocent in a series of lengthy Columbia University quasi-legal tribunals, despite the fact that he was not allowed to enter all his evidence and was not allowed to have a lawyer. For example, he was not allowed to enter the Facebook messages as evidence. He was under university sanctions for a time, which caused difficulties with his part-time job doing audiovisual work that required him to go to different places on campus, some of those places he was barred from. And even before his name was publicly released, he was being ostracized by people in the know. And it only got worse when his identity was publicly released, including in the university newspaper. Every day Sulkowitz carried her mattress, he was carrying the burden of allegations of rape that the many supporters of Sulkowitz obviously had no doubts about. On one occasion, reporters from the New York Post showed up outside his dorm room, and one of their photographers followed him to his class. Nungesser was effectively denied his own graduation ceremony because the university allowed Sulkowitz to carry her mattress on stage, and who knows what would have happened if Nungesser's name had been announced while he was mounting the stage, as is normal. To address the two other allegations of sexual assault against Nungesser, both of which he was cleared of in a university investigation, neither qualify as sexual assault, even if they had been found to be true. One was a former girlfriend who, after splitting for Nungesser for some time, and after running into Sulkowitz, decided that their relationship had been abusive because she felt that Nungesser only wanted to see her if they were going to have sex. But she eventually stopped cooperating with the university investigation. In the other case, a girl alleged that Nungesser had grabbed her at a party and tried to kiss her while they were briefly alone in a room. The three women who have accused Nungesser of sexual impropriety do agree that they coordinated their complaints to the university. Nungesser calls that collusion. As for the police complaint, the New York DA investigated but decided that there was not reasonable suspicion to proceed. Strangely, Sulkowitz claimed that she had caused the charges to be dropped, but it's not usually possible for a complainant to do this once a criminal complaint is filed. This again seems counter to the actions of someone seeking justice. It could be that she had concluded that nobody was going to give her justice, even though that seems fatalistic, but given the treatment of courts to rape victims, perhaps not unrealistic. She may have realized what the consequences for Noongesser could be and didn't want to be responsible for them. She may have simply used the complaint as a way to force his name into the public. We will never know unless Selkowitz starts talking again and agrees to an interview with someone who is at least a little bit skeptical of some of the details of her story. Now Noongesser is suing Columbia University for not stopping what he calls gender-based harassment, and he is also suing art professor John Kessler, who encouraged Selkowitz's mattress-carrying project. Like many people adjusting to the new sexual freedom of a university campus, Noongesser and Selkowitz had complicated relationships. With each other, they were mostly friends, mostly platonic. But they had a couple of times ended up with sex, even though they had other relationships at the same time. They had talked about this and decided that for them it wasn't a good idea. In one conversation, Selkowitz was comfortable enough with Noongesser to ask him to talk to her boyfriend about always using a condom when having sex with girls other than Selkowitz, a level of infidelity that Selkowitz apparently grudgingly tolerated. Another time, she told Noongesser that she had tested positive for an STD after having sex at a party both with her boyfriend and his best friend. She talked about drinking too much and doing drugs and complained about having sex while she was feeling like she was going to puke from too much alcohol. She indicated that she felt that she had been sexually assaulted several times in the past. Are there plausible reasons why Selkowitz would falsely charge sexual assault? Perhaps there are quite a few. She was struggling in her classes, and the trauma of a sexual assault with her attacker still on campus was a plausible excuse, whether it was true or not. She may have been feeling spurned by Noongesser after he went back to Europe for the summer and told her that he was in a new relationship, even though they had never been in an official romantic relationship. After deciding to launch her project of carrying a mattress, she would have had no way out, particularly after her protest went viral. She received awards. She got taken to a meeting with the president. Other people launched similar protests. How could she have stopped it once it got outside of her control? It is clear that women are less likely to resort to violence than men. This is partly innate, and partly due to the biological reality that the average man is bigger and stronger than the average woman. But when it comes to other character flaws, I think that men and women are pretty equal. Jealousy, vanity, laziness, excessive behavior such as overdrinking, infidelity, irrational anger. Men and women are both equally capable of these, and many more. In our confrontational justice system, we may never find the truth. Noongesser will probably win a settlement against Columbia. Part of that will probably be an agreement to buy his silence, and then from him we'll hear no more. And it appears that Selkowitz, now she has graduated and finished carrying her mattress, will now be silent. Actually, I wrote this before I found out that's not quite true. I'll get to that in a minute. It doesn't make sense for her to talk anymore. If she was raped, she must have concluded that there will never be another investigation. And if she wasn't raped and admitted it, she could face criminal sanctions. So the truth, whatever it is, cannot help her now. Although Selkowitz actually hasn't really talked about this rape recently, in a late update, she's released a performance art video called Ceci n'est pas un viol, which translates to This Is Not Rape. And it's Ceci n'est pas un viol de .com. This performance art video recreates a rape that, despite a disclaimer, has several similarities to what she claimed happened with Noongesser. Selkowitz plays herself, or at least the woman being raped, with a man whose face is blurred. I say reportedly because the website appears to have stopped functioning after a few people saw and reported on the video. So I haven't seen the video, but I have seen some screenshots from it and some descriptions. The text of the video contains a statement that appears to be designed to make the viewer feel voyeuristic and guilty. Quote, if you watch this video without my consent, then I hope you reflect on your reasons for objectifying me and participating in my rape. For in that case, you were the one who couldn't resist the urge to make Ceci n'est pas un viol about what you wanted to make it about, rape. That is an interesting statement about consent. If you put out a public video, aren't you giving consent to watch it? Or is this a test to see which people cannot resist the urge to see a woman getting raped, even if it's not reality? I assume that the title, "This Is Not a Rape," is a comment on Nungesser's denial. But Nungesser is not saying that physical violence is not rape. He is saying that the physical violence did not happen and that the sex was consensual. In fact, in his legal complaint against the university, he states that it was Sulkowitz who actually asked him to perform anal sex on her because she said that she'd done it with some former boyfriends and liked it. The question is not the definition of rape or sexual assault, but whether the specific situation was consensual or forced. And while men may have pretty much a monopoly on violence, they don't have a monopoly on other character flaws, such as being dishonest. The law, similar to many other forms of decision-making, cannot get away from the conceit or delusion that there is guilt that can be distinguished from innocence by drawing a line. It is true that guilt is seen as of shades of gray through the use of aggravating or mitigating factors that may affect the punishment. But there is still a huge gulf in punishment between someone who, it is decided, has just stepped over the line compared to someone who is just short of the line. This is particularly true in the case of criminal decisions where guilt results in, at minimum, prison sentences measured in years. And it is quite plausible that the exact same situation may be declared as innocence by another arbiter, in which case the accused would suffer no consequences. It is true that there are lesser forms of sanctions with looser definitions of guilt or innocence, such as civil trials or organizational investigations, such as those that occurred at Columbia University. But that just emphasizes that while guilt and innocence exist, there is a gray area between them that can be quite broad, and this is where the difficulty occurs. I should also say that in the United States, where a rapist may get a sentence of 1 or 2 years, it may be seen as some people as not that significant, not that harsh. But the reality is, in the United States in particular, that once you've been declared a felon, it may be very difficult for you to ever work again. You will be ineligible for many forms of public support, such as public housing. You may not be able to vote. You can't get food stamps. And so your entire life will be turned upside down, and it's almost like the purpose of the criminal justice system is to make sure that people stay within it. So even a 1 year prison sentence or something like that, the damage that it does to a person should not be underestimated. And of course, if the person is innocent, it's damage without justification. Anyway, a recent example of this principle is a case in England of a prominent and once sought-after classical music teacher named Malcolm Layfield, who had serial sexual affairs with many of his young female students. I really don't think that this is that uncommon. In one case, he is being accused of rape for sex that occurred in the back seat of a car in the 1980s, when his student was 18 and he was married in his 30s with young children. The question is not, however, about the morality or wisdom of the situation. It's whether it is criminal. Given that there are apparently no witnesses, and obviously no physical evidence, it's hard to see how he could be found guilty if the principle is innocent until proven guilty. It is quite possible that the woman is sincere, that she felt at the time that she needed to continue the relationship, which she did for 6 weeks, or he would have sabotaged her career as a musician. She may very well genuinely feel that he had this power. This might also be a conclusion that she only came to much later. He may be equally sincere in claiming that he believes that he had little influence on the careers of his students at the time, that the sex was consensual, and that she was an eager participant in the initiation of the affair. In cases like this, it is hard to separate the moral issues from the criminal. Many institutions forbid such relationships, even when the student sincerely feels that it is a loving relationship among equals. It is likely that many young, newly sexually mature people, students of both genders, have such relationships, and that some of them may remember the experience with fondness, some with regret, some with genuine anger. Their feelings may significantly change when they realize that they were not the one, but just one in a long series with a man like Layfield, who was obviously a serial adulterer, taking advantage of the string of young women who came through his studio. But if a woman is above the age of sexual consent and willingly participates in the sexual relationships, perhaps even initiates it, they are surely taking responsibility for their sexual independence. And it feels wrong and an injustice that a woman can turn around and allege that they were not actually capable of making their own sexual decisions because they were too young and immature. If an 18-year-old woman is not capable of making a sexual decision like that, then at what age should sexual consent be raised to? And should the age just be raised for women? Should every person have an individual age, and who would decide? Would young people revolt, perhaps quite rightly, if such a regime was imposed? It seems obviously absurd. If there is an age of consent, then it should be respected for both men and women. And although there could be some sanctions in this case, because this man may have violated the ethics of his institution, they probably should not be criminal if it was a consensual sexual relationship. We now accept that women, just like men, can experience sexual desire and even lust. And both genders can experience their rationality being swept away by the irrationality that comes particularly with the strong sex drive of young, previously celibate people who are in lust or love or both. And like most people in their youth, men and women both probably make some bad sexual decisions and may cringe inside when they remember a particularly unwise relationship or situation. But it also seems unwise for society to allow people to decide, after a sexual relationship has terminated, that it was actually never consensual, even though it certainly appeared to have been at the time. In this English case, how likely is it that a relationship that started with a rape in the back of a car would continue as an admittedly consensual relationship for the following 6 weeks? The claim that traumatized women behave strangely, which is also the case in the also has been claimed in the Sulkowitz case, where she sent loving Facebook messages to Nongesser for a couple of months after the events. These women may profess their love for their alleged rapist for a long time afterwards. How can you tell if the messages professing affection and love or the signs of love, such as the continuation of a sexual relationship, how can you tell if they're genuine or a reaction to a traumatic sexual assault? What if everything can be interpreted as a reaction to a traumatic event? Then it would be impossible for someone falsely accused of sexual assault to prove their innocence. In this English case, I'm sure the woman felt used. I'm sure she was being used. Layfield was in the position of having an unending series of young women coming to him, developing an emotional bond through the shared passion of music, and he probably knew that there was always going to be another young woman who would either make a pass at him or would be amenable to seduction on his part. His behavior is morally questionable, perhaps unethical, despicable, or creepy, but I can't see how it is criminal without reverting to a Victorian model of women. In a case in Canada that involves education about sexual assault, not sexual assault itself, Julie Lalonde, an educator, was shocked at the hostility she found while educating military cadets at Canada's main officer training university. Nobody in the coverage of the story mentioned the irony of teaching military cadets how to treat Canadian women with respect when they are at the same time being trained to follow orders and treat both foreign men and women as objects to be eliminated, i.e. killed, when ordered to. But this is an aside. The cadets certainly did not appear to be overly receptive to her point of view and may have been quite rude, both during the class and afterwards, which is not forgivable. But the class openly revolted when she answered a question about a situation in which both a man and a woman were drunk, and she insisted that the man could be charged with sexual assault, not the woman. This seems like a reasonable conundrum to me. Things are clearer if a woman is clearly incapacitated by alcohol, perhaps barely conscious, and a man is not. But what if it is the other way around? What if both are drunk, but the man is drunker than the woman? If we think about drinking and driving, there is no question that someone who gets into a car and causes an accident while inebriated is responsible for his or her actions. And rightly, a man who is sober or drunk who takes advantage of a woman lying semi-conscious on the couch and has sex with her is clearly responsible for his actions. But it hardly seems fair that a man is always responsible, but a woman loses her responsibility with the first couple of drinks. Returning to college campuses, in a case well documented by Slate magazine, two undergrads at Occidental College both got drunk and had sex for the first time one night. In this case, there were plenty of witnesses. Let me clarify that they had sex for the first time with each other. There was no implication that they were both virgins. In this case, there were plenty of witnesses. John, not his real name, had been chugging booze while being hazed by his water polo team. He talked about being ready to black out. Shortly after, Jane, also not her real name, also drunk, stumbled in. Quoting Amanda Hess's Slate article, "Eventually both Jane and John removed their own shirts while dancing. When Jane ended up lying on top of John on his bed and grinding her hips on him, a couple of her friends pulled her away and tried to lead her back to her own bed. She was a little upset and indignant, one of them reported, but agreed to return to her room. She didn't stay there. John texted her, 'The second that you're away from them, come back.' Jane replied, 'Okay, do you have a condom?' 'Yes,' he replied. Jane did eventually sneak out of her room, past her friends and her resident advisor, and made her way back to John's room, where she performed oral sex on him, which Jane says she remembers doing, but John says he can't recall. And they began having sex, which both later said they didn't remember. When another student knocked on the door to ask if Jane was okay, she responded affirmatively three times. Later, another student opened the door and saw them having sex. According to investigators, this witness had attended sexual assault prevention training during orientation and had been told what to do if he witnessed a sexual assault. So he closed the door and let John and Jane continue because, he told investigators, this didn't look like sexual assault to me. Later, Jane filed a complaint against John, and he was found in violation of the policy which forbids students from having sexual contact with anyone who is incapacitated by drugs or alcohol. John was expelled. Jane, despite clearly also having violated the policy, probably more so than John, who appeared to have been more incapacitated, suffered no consequences. Clearly, this seems unfair, and John is suing the college and will probably win. A story occurs in several ancient mythologies in which a woman falls in love with a forbidden man and then, when rejected, accuses him of rape, and in some stories kills herself, and in some of them the man is killed by other people. From an Egyptian papyrus from 1250 BC, it is written that the wife of Anubis attempts to seduce Bata, her husband's handsome brother. When he spurns her advances, she makes herself look like she has been violently raped and tells her husband Anubis that Bata did it. This leads Anubis to want to kill his brother Bata. In the Bible, there is a story of Joseph in which his master's wife repeatedly asks him to have sex with her. So take that, biblical fundamentalists. When she tries to grab him, he runs away without his clothes, and she calls out that he had tried to rape her. In Greek mythology, the story of Phaedra is one in which she fell in love with her stepson, Hippolytus. Through a servant, she propositions him, but he is repelled by her advances and refuses. Phaedra hangs herself, but leaves a suicide note saying that she did it out of shame because Hippolytus had raped her. her husband Theseus, then chases after Hippolytus, who dies in the sea with some assistance from the god Poseidon. It is interesting that when we are told a story, even a folk tale, then we are in the privileged position of knowing the truth, or at least we think we know the truth. In reality, we just believe what the storyteller wants us to believe. These stories could be interpreted in two different ways, possibly more if I was more imaginative. One is that the woman really was raped, and because the story is told by a man, he gets away with blaming the woman for trying to seduce him. And I'm sure this has been used many times throughout history. The other is that it is the story of a woman who is genuinely attracted to a man that she shouldn't have, according to local mores and ethics. In the Greek example, it was common for young women to be married to older, rich men, so it wouldn't be uncommon for the wife of an older man to have more in common with his son from a previous marriage. So falling in love with a stepson isn't as bizarre as it sounds. And it's not even incest, because a stepson has no relationship with the new wife. He could quite easily be of a similar age. And if the woman was emotionally and sexually unfulfilled by a husband, her actions are a lot more understandable. But imagine if the storyteller just told you the simple facts. Theseus comes home and finds his wife hanging from the rafter with a note blaming her stepson for raping us. In this case, we would probably believe the note. It's all a matter of perspective and what we choose to believe, because we can't prove either case. My point with this discussion is not to deny that sexual assault happens, nor to deny that men are usually the perpetrators. It's clear that sexual abuse of women has happened for millennia, and it is good that society is slowly starting to grapple with the problem, but we cannot throw justice out of the window. We cannot oversimplify the problem by, for example, assuming that women never lie about sexual matters. In fact, women have lots of reasons to lie about their sexual experiences, good or bad, and some of these reasons overlap with the reason sexual assault has been tolerated for so long. The idealized woman in our society is supposed to be both sexualized, maternal, and virginal, to be monogamous throughout life, to satisfy a man sexually, without being overly obsessed with her own sexual satisfaction and without any previous experience, to dress attractively but not provocatively. Men are to some extent affected by some of the same standards, but it's to a much lesser degree. Also, the sexual escapades of men are much more likely to be forgiven, even celebrated. So women who have a sexual experience that bothers them may be feeling shame derived from the expectations society has burdened them with. This is a similar situation, although it manifests in different ways, with gay men who are not always able to escape the feelings of shame that society has tried to inculcate in them for their entire life. I'm going out on a limb here, but I hypothesize that when women follow through on their sexual feelings, but then something goes wrong, perhaps because their inhibitions have been loosened by drugs or alcohol, or perhaps because they realize that they love their lover more than he loves them, or because they feel sexually inadequate, or because they feel that this is sex they shouldn't have had, they will feel shame due to societal expectations. And one way out of that shame is to claim that the sex was coercive. And the more that the definition of consent is tightened, and the more that the burden is placed on men to manage our new definition of consent, the more false allegations of sexual assault, and the more injustices that will occur. And once an allegation is made, societal and even legal pressures make it unlikely to be publicly retracted. In one way, I don't think this problem is very big. There are millions of highly sexually active people around. Many of them are prone to drinking to excess on occasion, and to using drugs, yet there are very few cases such as those I've detailed today. On the other hand, this is a big problem because these few cases are being used to drive policy on the sexual relationships between men and women. It's kind of like the broken windows policing policy. If people get arrested for minor violations, they won't commit major violations. That's the theory. But that isn't working for policing crimes, and I don't think it will work for sexual relationships. It will just end up criminalizing a lot of men, emphasizing that women are not sexually independent, and generating lawsuits. Apart from lawyers, it's hard to see anyone benefiting. Ironically, it could also end up criminalizing women. Are we getting to the point where we are unable to tell women that they are responsible for their sexual relationship, that it's okay to make sexual mistakes, but that as long as the relationship is not coercive, that what to do about it is a private matter? Particularly in the United States, is the influence of the religious right and hostility to honest sex education embedding a sense of shame in the sexuality of modern women, especially the vast majority who have multiple sexual partners, at least in their youth? Have we stopped telling them that it's okay to have multiple sexual experiences before they find Mr. Right, if that's what they want to do? Did we ever tell them that that was okay and normal? Are we sending the message that female sexual desire is wrong, and that if you succumb to it, it must be somebody else's fault? Thank you for listening to episode 61 of The Infectious Myth. I would really like to get comments on this episode in particular, so if you have comments or suggestions for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at Infectious Myth. I particularly would like to hear guest suggestions who can cover the other side of this story or other stories. I do genuinely want to look at issues from multiple perspectives. So if you could help me out in that area, I would greatly appreciate it. And until next week, goodbye.